From GPB News, this is On Second Thought. I'm Celeste Headlee. Today, we talk about garbage.
I'm the trash man. I come out, I throw trash all over the ring, and then I start eating garbage.
We'll look at how Atlanta is on track to modernize its trash pickup system. First, though, we spoke yesterday about the life and work of philanthropist Joan Kroc. Author Lisa Napoli wrote a biography of Kroc and her husband Ray. Ray helped found McDonald's. And she told us how Ray's drinking problems inspired Joan to invest in addiction and alcoholism prevention. That giving touched Georgia.
In fact, Morehouse, in your neighborhood there, was an early recipient of a $1 million grant for something called Operation Cork, Kroc spelled backwards, the foundation of much alcoholism education research in the 70s, and that continues on today.
We asked for your comments, and here are your first thoughts. Twitter user Voltron Twan says, I volunteer with the Atlanta Kroc Center and see the positive impact on communities in Atlanta. Thankful for Joan Kroc's vision and gift. You can tweet us like Voltron Twan did. It's at OST Talk. You can also call us and leave a message. It's 404-500-9457, or just post on Facebook. And remember, we might feature your comments on the show. And now let's talk a little trash. Last month, the city of Atlanta announced it is a test pilot for a new software-based trash pickup system. Our city is the first partner of waste management company Rubicon Global, who says the program will cut costs for the city and help combat climate change. With me via Skype is Michael Allegretti. He's head of public policy for Rubicon Global. Hi, Michael.
Hi, Celeste. Thanks for having me.
And also here to explain how this works is Stephanie Stuckey Benfield, sustainability director for the city of Atlanta. Hi, Stephanie.
Good morning. Thanks for having me.
So, Michael, help me understand how software changes the way you pick up. I mean, you think that picking up trash is just going down each street and picking up the garbage where there's bins, right? So how does software change that?
Well, you know, you can't improve what you can't measure. So at the end of the day, this is really about moving this industry, the waste and recycling industry, out of the dark ages and away from a landfill model, which is an opaque model, where knowing how much waste you produce, when it's produced, and what's in it isn't advantageous to the business. Moving away from that to a model where citizens and governments and businesses actually understand how much they're producing and where the opportunities are to recycle and reuse materials, not just to help the environment, but also to make money. So at the most basic level, data and analytics and transparency help to move us away from landfills and towards a greener future.
Stephanie, what does that look like in realistic pictures on the streets of the city?
Well, first, let me just make a quick correction. I've had a change in title. I'm now Chief Resilience Officer for the City of Atlanta as part of the Rockefeller Foundation. And the resilience program includes sustainability. So, okay. I did want to give that quick change. So there will be no discernible difference for the regular Atlanta homeowner as to how their trash is picked up. What the Rubicon Global Project brings for City of Atlanta residents is that we are going to start measuring at a real granular level our trash and our recycling. And as a result of that, we hope at the end of this six-month pilot study period to come up with some solid recommendations for how we can be more efficient.
Meaning you're going to measure how much really belongs in a landfill, how much is recyclable. You also know how much people are recycling as opposed to throwing into their garbage?
That's right. And the cool thing about this technology is right now we have data based on quadrants, which is how we schedule our pickups. So we have different pickup days for the different quadrants.
Divide the city into squares. And
exactly. Yeah. So we just have quadrant level data. This gives us data per individual household. And especially what we need to know is who's recycling.
I got to stop you again. You know, if I live in Atlanta, you're going to know whether I'm recycling or not?
That's right. And we're not trying to be the trash police. What we're trying to do is encourage people to recycle. And we can't really target the homes where people are not recycling unless we know who's not recycling.
Right.
So this data is going to enable us to be more effective in our communications and our outreach strategy.
How do you do this, Michael? I mean, how do you know which addresses are recycling? Because they all get thrown into the same bin, right? I mean, how do you separate people's trash by address?
So the tech, think, is a It's app-based tech. So essentially all 60-plus Department of Public Works trucks in the city of Atlanta will be outfitted with our technology on a smartphone. And the principle of the tech is interaction by exception. That's what's so cool about this company and about this technology. It was developed through the eyes of the men and women on the front lines slinging trash bags and driving trucks. So as the truck's rolling down the street, based on a number of things, and we have dozens of patents pending and approved, they combine GPS, the change in hydraulics of the truck, various shaking mechanisms, all these different triggers essentially confirm that a service has taken place. But if a driver sees something when he or she goes to remove the trash that's out of whack, let's say a bin that's contaminated or it's overflowing, they can actually record that in real time right on the app and have a digital record of that.
Stephanie, what other things can you imagine using this kind of, that's a lot of data, right? I mean, I would imagine there's a lot of different uses for it. For example, maybe there's a household that doesn't realize that you can recycle certain kinds of plastic and they were throwing them away. Is that the kind of thing that you can actually learn?
That's right. And so we want to be able to more effectively communicate to Atlanta residents what they should and shouldn't be recycling. So this data will be incredibly informative in that regard. We're also looking at route maximization. So are we really doing the most effective routing of our trash trucks? So that is the type of technology that Rubicon brings to the table. What's really innovative about Rubicon Global, unlike other trash hauler companies, is that they have a zero waste goal. They're not in the business of owning landfills and making a profit out of how much trash you can bring to the landfills, which is how most waste management companies make their money. Rubicon Global wants to divert waste from the landfills. They want to get more waste in the recycling stream. And so we're improving our greenhouse gas emissions and we're improving our quality of life. So we're really excited to be partnering with Rubicon Global. They're also, I've got to give a shout out for City of Atlanta. They're an Atlanta-based business.
If you're just joining us, we're talking about trash, and I'm speaking with, tell me your new title again.
Chief Resilience Officer is part of Rockefeller Foundation's 100 Resilient Cities program.
That's a long title.
I know. But it's an exciting title. We'll have another show on that.
Stephanie Stuckey Benfield. Atlanta is the test pilot for a new software-based trash pickup system, and so we have Michael Allegretti with us from Rubicon Global, who developed that software. So, Michael, I have to think that I'm not the only person who is thinking, are we entering the era of the trash big brother? Like, how far is it? How far away are we from Atlanta knowing that I'm not recycling, that I just tossed my aluminum can into the garbage, and then somebody showing up, the trash police showing up at my door saying, all right, pay $5 for not recycling your Coca-Cola can.
All right, well, fair enough. You see, the issue is, right now, Atlanta already knows that. The difference is they can't communicate with you about it. They don't have the means to be in touch, to kind of track that, and to start to change your behavior for the better of the city. So knowing about it's one thing, but knowing about it and being able to do something about it is where the change is happening. And, you know, for us, this, as a company, the Rubicon Global story up until now has been one about small business empowerment. We have about 5,000 independent haulers across all 50 states, and we work with them to service small, medium, and big national customers who want more cost-effective and environmentally sustainable solutions for their waste. But now with Atlanta, the story evolves. It goes to a new chapter about government efficiency, smart cities, resilient cities, responsive cities. It's really about, if you're going to have a tax dollar paid, you need to get the full value of that dollar back through a service. And I like to think that the Rubicon software in this partnership will kind of maximize the value of that tax dollar.
How do you make money doing that, though? Because, look, I can't even recycle my glass anymore because they said it's not profitable. So I have to throw glass, one of the most easily recyclable materials on the planet, sure, into the garbage. So how do you make money without using a landfill?
Celeste, a lot of that has to do with the messenger. If you're speaking to a landfill company, and the big incumbents in the industry own dozens and dozens of landfills that they need to fill in order to be profitable. So the math for them isn't going to be the same as for a company like ours, who's out there basically looking at all of our customers and saying, give us your trash. As our CEO and founder, Nate Morris, says, trash is a tremendous opportunity. The key is to have a lot of it and to have it sanitized and then to sell it on the secondary markets.
Stephanie, what are some of the biggest mistakes people make with their garbage? Is it that they're not recycling all the things that they can recycle, or what are the biggest educational opportunities, I might phrase it that way, for the average consumer?
The biggest problem we're seeing is contamination and failure to recycle. So those are the two.
So you're not rinsing out their recycling items? Is that what you mean?
No, it's people putting items in the recycling bin that don't belong there.
Like batteries.
The number one, batteries is one, but the number one item that people throw in the recycling bin that they shouldn't, can you guess?
Styrofoam.
Plastic
diapers.
Bags. Plastic bags.
Grocery bags, yeah.
Yes, people think that plastic bags are recyclable, and it's what I call magical recycling or wishful recycling. People think, oh, if we put it in there enough, eventually it will be recycled. The problem is plastic bags are not recyclable through our recycling system, and I don't know any city that does recycle plastic bags as part of their single-stream residential pickup.
But there are cities that don't allow plastic bags anymore.
That's
and
right.
They want you to use reusable.
We're not there
bags.
Yet. I certainly encourage people to use reusable, but we're not banning plastic bags at the city level yet. That's not on our immediate agenda. For now, we're just trying to educate residents. If they would just keep plastic bags out of the recycling bin, that would be such a tremendous boost to us. We're showing in some quadrants up to 43% contamination, and most of that's coming from plastic bags and also food. The other thing is styrofoam, and you're seeing people throw cups, paper cups that are plastic lined. And so a lot of this is just education. In the past 2 months, Office of Sustainability has gone out and talked to every single MPU in Atlanta and educated them about what you can and can't put in your recycling bin. But that's only reaching a small fraction of the residents in Atlanta.
And the problem, Michael, with contamination is that it's so expensive to separate it out. Is that correct?
Exactly. It's just it adds a cost to the process, and then the math gets harder and harder to work in terms of making recycling sustainable. That's the key. So making, you know, we talk about sustainability, making cities more sustainable, but to make recycling more sustainable, it's not just kind of a green endeavor. It has to be a financially feasible one. And that means that at the front of the process, you need citizens and businesses to do their part.
So we only have a minute left, Stephanie, but the promise is that this program will cut costs for the city. How is that going to work?
Well, if we can hone in on how people are not recycling right and use that to help educate, then we're going to be able to get more people to recycle and recycle right. And that will improve our profitability. We want recycling to be a profit venture, which it should be for the city. And that saves residents money. They're spending less taxpayer dollars on their recycling program. And it helps save the environment and improves the quality of our air. I don't think people realize how much our greenhouse gas emissions are caused by landfills, because landfills produce an incredible amount of methane, which is actually more potent than carbon emissions. So there are many benefits to residents, from environmental savings to actual financial savings.
That is Stephanie Stuckey Benfield. She is the resilience
officer
for the city of Atlanta. Atlanta is the test pilot for this new software-based trash pickup system. Michael Allegretti is with Rubicon Global that developed the software. Michael and Stephanie, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Thank you. Have a great day.
Just ahead, we look at the chemical compounds that made human life possible. First, though, a conversation with Pulitzer Prize-winning historian and legal expert Edward Larson. This is On Second Thought. It's On Second Thought. I'm Celeste Headlee. I'm sure some of you got some great gifts over the holidays. Maybe. One of the things I found under my tree was a beautiful hand-painted ceramic vase. But you know what? There was a great big sticker, a price tag stuck onto the vase, and I had a heck of a time getting that price tag off. I bet many of us could rant on that particular subject, and I know my acting senior producer Don Smith can, because he has a thing or two to say about price tags. So guess what? It's time to open the gripe bag.
I don't like things now compared to the way they used to be.
You know what really grinds my gears?
All this progress. Phooey!
Will you please tell me why?
That's the way it was, and we liked it.
Get off my lawn!
I yield to no one in my appreciation of places that find ways to charge less for things you actually need or want to buy. Good old American competition. But there is an apparent fear that some bottom-dwelling sneaks will somehow manage to remove or swap price tags on everything from gift bags to golf balls to signs that describe how Mama's disposition determines everyone else's, you know, if Mama ain't happy, etc., etc. These price tags are attached to whatever they deface with stickum that would probably work to repair battleships. They are often located where they can best be seen. They are usually designed to break into a number of smaller pieces, each as sticky and impossible to get off your fingers and hands as modern science can devise. They do not come off cleanly. There is residue left. That requires some chemical compound like Goo Gone to detach. This leaves a stink and sometimes a stain. Trying to get the goo off with a tool of some sort often results in gouges, scratches, even breakage. Is there now or was there ever an epidemic of price tag swapping? Are modern science and technology incapable of devising price tagging that does not require tear-apart tags attached with adhesive from hell? We never had this problem at Rich's.
That is Don Smith. He is the acting senior producer for On Second Thought. To hear more of his rants and others, visit gpbnews.org. The centennial year of the Pulitzer Prize ended Saturday night, but our series on the prize continues. In Pulitzer Peaches, we feature winners from or with a connection to the state of Georgia. And today we discuss the work of author Edward Larson. He won his Pulitzer for History in 1998 for his book, Summer of the Gods, The Scopes Trial, and America's Continuing Debate Over Science and Religion. Larson is formerly a professor of history and law at the University of Georgia and still serves there as senior fellow at the Institute of Higher Education. Edward Larson joins me now via phone. Hi there.
Good morning.
And I guess this would be a year's delayed congratulations on the Pulitzer win. It's really just an excuse to talk to you because one of the contentions that you make in your book, which I think especially this past political year has made clear, is that the Scopes Monkey trial, regardless of how we teach it in high school, did not settle the legal question over evolution. Is that accurate?
That's certainly the way I view it as a historian. The myth of Scopes comes from a wonderful play and movie, Inherit the Wind, a play and movie I love, but was never written about, actually, the Scopes trial. I got to know the authors of that play quite well, Bob Lee and Jerry Lawrence, and as they freely admitted at the time and in the preface, that play they wrote, which became the movie, was actually about McCarthyism. It was much like The Crucible by Arthur Miller. Really wasn't about the witchcraft trials. It was about an attack on McCarthyism, but they used a past event, which ends up significantly transforming that event and portrays it in very different ways because you have to have tolerance, happily triumph over the bigotry that is the McCarthy-like bigotry that is wrongly actually attributed to William Jennings Bryan. And so you get a skewed view of the trial, and that's what folklore does. It transforms history and uses it for a current purpose, but ended up severely misunderstanding and giving us a misguided view of the actual effects of the Scopes trial, where it was really, in many ways, the opening blast, the guns of August, as it were, in a century-long culture wars that's still continuing today.
And just as a reminder for everyone, in case Scopes Monkey trial is going straight past and through them, that was a legal case from 1925, which was actually the state of Tennessee versus a science teacher, John Scopes. He was accused of violating, and please correct me, Edward, if I'm not remembering this correctly, but he was accused of violating the Butler Act. He was not supposed to teach evolution in a public school, correct?
Yes, it became quite a Southern story. in the sense that Tennessee was portrayed, and Dayton, Tennessee in particular, is rural, is the rural South. And here, there had, the state had passed a law limiting the teaching of human evolution, not any form of evolution, but just human evolution in public schools. But it was actually done at the urging of William Jennings Bryan, who was not a Southerner, and it was pushed on by national evangelical organizations based in places like Minneapolis and Los Angeles and Toronto and Boston and New York. And it just happened that the first law that passed in this national crusade happened to be in Tennessee. But no one ridiculed the law more than the Atlanta Georgian and the reporters sent up from Atlanta who joined in the national media pillaring of this Tennessee town, which actually had nothing to do whatsoever with the law. The law had been passed by the state. The city wasn't even enforcing it. It was staging a show trial, a test case, to determine if the law was valid.
And at the end of that trial, the teacher was found guilty, actually, and his fine was, I think, $100, but that the verdict was eventually overturned. But my question was, there was a victory. There was a clear outcome in that case of whether or not it should be legal to teach evolution in schools. And therefore, why wasn't this settled nearly 100 years ago? If this was already in our courts, with courts deciding, judges making pronouncements, why are we still debating this?
Well, it wasn't really settled by the case. What you had was a situation where what the people attacking the law, was prompted by an ad by the American Civil Liberties Union asking to offering to challenge any Tennessee school teacher willing to challenge the law in court. And that's what ended up happening. And so the idea was this national organization was staging a test case. Now, in Dayton, the prosecution effectively limited the issue to whether Scopes had actually taught evolution. In reality, he hadn't, but he couldn't take the stand, but it was a range that people would say that he had. He wasn't a biology teacher, was the issue. He was a football coach. But he was the one who'd volunteered to test the case. So we had the situation where even the defense, when it was ruled that all we're testing is whether he taught evolution, the defense conceded that because they wanted to get to a higher court to test the law on appeal. And a former justice of the Supreme Court, Charles Evan Hughes, had volunteered to handle the case in the United States Supreme Court. The problem was it never got back past the Tennessee Supreme Court because the Tennessee Supreme Court overturned Scopes's conviction on a technicality that the fine had been imposed wrongly by a 3-2 margin, said that the law was constitutional, but then went on to direct that the prosecutors not reindict Scopes, and indeed direct the prosecutors of Tennessee never to enforce this, to quote, disturb the peace and dignity of Tennessee by ever enforcing this law again.
Wow, it's way more tangled.
They wanted to be reelected.
Yeah, it's way more tangled than the great movie.
Yes, it is. And that's the reason, that was the purpose of my book.
Okay, so let me fast forward this. And if you're just joining us, I'm speaking with author and historian Edward Larson. He won a Pulitzer Prize in 1998 for his book Summer of the Gods, The Scopes Trial and America's Continuing Debate Over Science and Religion, longtime faculty member at the University of Georgia. So, Edward, let me bring this to 2017, because you are an expert in this intersection between science and religion and the law and history, and we seem to be there. How similar is the debate over evolution in schools to the debate over climate change and how that intersects with religion and law and history and science?
Well, there are some similarities, except I don't view the climate change debate as a religious one. We don't really see the church taking a strong stand in one way or the other, such as we saw and still see churches taking the lead in the opposition to the teaching of evolution. But what we do see in both of them is a distrust of experts, a distrust of science, a belief that there are other ways of knowing and other expertise. So you do see those things in common, and we do see an alliance between this sort of activity. What we also see is with the ongoing creation evolution debate, we see a culture war in the sense that there are many people who believe that their pernicious effects on religious belief stemming from belief in Darwinian evolution. And so the idea that evolution should not be taught in public schools or should be taught in some restricted way has remained alive, and it has been used by politicians to build a divide in America that serves the purpose of various people actually on both sides.
So was the Scopes trial the beginning of this trust in scientists? And was it also the beginning of so-called politicized science? That's something that we've heard quite a bit, especially during this past election cycle, is how science is not supposed to be political and yet has been politicized. Was Scopes the beginning of that?
There was an easier alliance between science and religion before the rise of the harsher forms of Darwinian thinking, which was captured in the debate over the creation-evolution controversy. We also see the rise of the media and consumer culture and the popular press at this time. And with that sort of journalism, there was this increasing tendency to divide people over issues. So you saw people taking stands to advance themselves. So in many ways, the Scopes trial, if not actually the first, was the biggest one, the one that captured the national. It was front page news across the country. Transcripts were printed in every newspaper, including the Atlanta newspapers. It was broadcast live nationwide on the radio, the first broadcast trial in America. It was filmed and shown in movie halls. It was, by all accounts at the time, it was the biggest story of the year, if not the decade. And so in that sense, since it became such a huge cultural event that was latched onto and used for purposes that had nothing to do, actually, with science and education, in the sense that there were people who used it as a way to attack religion, attack the church, push modernism, also used as ways to restrict secularism and drive it back. And since it became that vehicle, it has lived on. One thing I've followed, in my research on this topic, I have found that over the years, in headlines and in news stories, there have literally been hundreds and hundreds of cases where the news report calls it either Scopes 2 or the son of Scopes. And these don't just involve evolution, though they often do. Teaching of evolution in public schools, they often might involve everything from transgendered bathrooms to gay rights. And they're called Scopes 2 or son of Scopes. I have never yet seen a single case called Scopes 3 or the grandchild of Scopes. The point is, everybody goes right back to the Scopes trial as their antecedent when something involves a battle between perceived secularism and perceived religion in American society. It has become one of America's great and powerful cultural legends.
So why do you think science, by many measures, is sort of losing this battle of credibility in public opinion? And I want to refer back to a segment you did on The Daily Show from 2005. It was a segment that they called Evolution Schmevolution. And I wonder if how much this debate and credibility has been affected by scientists' ability to relate to the average American person, to speak in a way that's easily understood.
I agree with the implications of your question. Scientists tend to be off doing science. They get their grants. They're good at what they do. They're not really trained to be speakers. Some of them are wonderful writers, like E.L. Wilson or Stephen Jay Gould used to be, or Carl Sagan, and wonderful communicators, but most of them aren't. And they're not interested in doing that. And they are interested in doing their job. And therefore, they are not a specialist at communicating their ideas. People are interested in science. People do pick up scientific ideas. People do read Scientific American, and they read the science sections of newspapers. But there isn't this automatic attachment. And scientific ideas have grown ever more complicated.
Yeah.
And detailed, and where a person might be able to wrap their head around the idea that the Earth went around the sun rather than the sun went around the Earth, it's pretty hard to wrap your head, most people's head, around string theory or some of the latest developments in science. And therefore, there tends to be, as science become more specialized and we all become more busy.
Yeah, it's harder. We have to, unfortunately, wrap it up there. That is author and historian Edward Larson, won a Pulitzer in 1998 for his book Summer of the Gods. Edward, it's been a real pleasure. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
This is On Second Thought. It's On Second Thought. I'm Celeste Headlee. Tomorrow, we're going to talk quite a bit about Georgia authors and Georgia writing. And we wonder, as you make your 2017 best book lists, who are your favorite authors? Who are you planning to read? It doesn't matter if they're living or dead. We just want to get your recommendations for good writers. 404-500-9457. You can also post on Facebook and be sure to join us tomorrow. The first living organisms on Earth were probably these single-celled life forms that are called archaea. They're very similar to bacteria, except in a particularly important piece missing. It took eons for those tiny little forms to evolve into humans. But how did that happen? A researcher at Georgia Tech is working to answer that question, the very roots of life. Nick Hudd is leading the effort to discover that, and he joins me in our studio. Good morning.
Good morning, Celeste.
So the piece missing from those very first life forms was the nucleus, and that's important to you because that's where the genetic material is usually held. Is that right?
Well, actually, what we're working on comes about earlier than the first cells that you mentioned. You mentioned that archaea, some people have hypothesized, are the earliest cells. They may be, but some of the very, very fundamental questions about the origin of life have to do with how did the molecules that made up those first cells come about. And so that's what we're working on.
Which is very difficult to track, obviously. And yes. And often we think of evolution as a biological process, and you're looking at it from a chemical process. How do you do that?
Well, we have some constraints on what molecules would have likely been present on the early Earth. We can run model chemical reactions that produce molecules that we find in life today, and also many other molecules that are closely related to those that we find in life. And what we're looking at is there the possibility that these molecules that are present in these relatively simple reaction products, can they come together and form larger molecules like those that we believe gave rise to life?
So how long ago are we talking?
This is on the order of 3.7 to 4 billion years ago.
Okay, so in order for life to form or for it to evolve, that means that at some point the organisms have to learn how to store information, right? They have to figure out how to remember.
Absolutely. And in fact, we think that some of the earliest molecules of life were what we would call informational polymers. Very similar
to... What does that mean?
I was going to say, these are long molecules. So poly meaning many, and mers just meaning that many things, many molecules connected together. And DNA is a great example of a polymer. There's many units connected together that store the genetic information of each cell. And so we believe that some of the earliest molecules that gave rise to life were similar to what DNA is today, but would have been simpler in some ways.
And shorter.
Oh, absolutely. The molecules that make up our genome, of course, you know, are billions of units in length. These probably would have been on the order of maybe 100 units in length.
And at what point was the RNA, the companion to the DNA, did that come along much, much later?
Well, some people actually think that RNA was one of the first molecules of life, and RNA is most likely older than DNA. Well, RNA is now kind of this intermediary between the storage of information in DNA and the synthesis of proteins in our living cells. RNA may have done a lot more early on in life.
What does this tell us? I mean, if we're going back billions and billions of years, how does this apply to scientific study today?
Well, if you look at the wonderful structures that life is able to make with the molecules that we have inside of living systems.
The molecules we have today, as opposed
exactly.
to the tiny, very simple ones that were present all the time ago.
Right. I think that it's easy to imagine that there must be some very, for lack of a better word, powerful chemistry that gave rise to life and all the structures that eventually make up life. And so we believe that if we can understand those earliest steps of life, it will open up a whole new dimension of chemistry. Chemistry of molecules that can spontaneously come together and start to evolve towards more sophisticated structures and capabilities.
What does that mean? What, for example, what kind of implications would this have for medicine, or would it? What kind? If we know the roots of life, how do we connect that to the complicated chemical and biological system that is a human body?
Well, in our search for new therapeutics, many times we're looking for molecules that act similar or have structures that are similar yet a little different than those that we have inside of our bodies. And so we're thinking that these molecules that we're working with or that we're looking for that could be the earliest ones of life could have great potential as new therapeutic molecules, but also because we feel there's a distinct possibility that these molecules, as I said, could evolve into more sophisticated forms, we could use these processes to actually guide us towards, say, new materials like biocompatible materials that you might use, say, in implants or for the delivery of therapeutic agents.
Okay, I am not a scientist. I was a music major, so I'm going to try to break down what you just
sure.
said. You're talking about finding molecules that are so basic that it's similar to sort of a stem cell, that they could be used in a bunch of different things because they're such a primary structure?
Well, let's think of it this way. The cells, all cells, not just stem cells, but every cell in your body is made up of some basic materials, such as proteins, nucleic
right.
acids, right? And so we can use proteins and nucleic acids as therapeutic agents.
Right.
Right. We can also use molecules that are related to these, closely related, say changing one atom here, one atom there. Gives them little different properties, sometimes allows them to last longer, say, within a living system, within our bodies. And so what we're thinking is that the first molecules that appeared in life probably were a little different than those we have in life today.
Yeah.
But because of that, they might actually have some special properties that are very beneficial in the development of new therapeutic agents.
That's really interesting. And my last question for you is, you have mentioned that this research that you're doing on the roots of life might actually have implications for space exploration. What does that mean?
Well, in order to determine whether life exists on another planet or has a possibility to have at one time or in the future exist on a planet, we need to understand the chemistry that gives rise to life. And of course, our best example of life is here on Earth,
yeah.
right? So understanding how life on Earth got started, I think, is going to be extremely important for guiding our search for life in other places in the universe.
That is Georgia Tech researcher Nick Hudd, his research focus on the roots of life on Earth. Thank you so much.
You're welcome.
Atlanta teenager Nzinga Braswell traveled to Ghana in 2015 and documented her journey on film. The result was a film called A Queen's Discovery, And the piece was recently honored by a PDS Film Festival. And Zynga joins me in our studio. Good morning.
Good morning.
A little early for you?
Yeah, just a little.
Also with us is Zynga's collaborator on the film, her father, Kenneth. He's director of President Obama's National Responsible Fatherhood Clearinghouse. He's also the executive director of the group Fathers Incorporated here in Atlanta. Kenneth, it's good to have you as well.
Good morning. Thank you so much.
And Zynga, what did you hope to get out of the trip to Ghana?
I just hope to learn something new about a new place, and I really hope to, like, allow my journey to change me as a person and to help people, to help change other things that were going on.
And did that happen?
Yes, I was definitely changed as a person. I learned a lot of things from my trip, and I'm trying right now to help change their lives in Ghana, too.
So you made this film, and have you gone back and rewatched the film, I assume, a few times since then?
Yes, I've watched it a few times.
So, because it looks like some of that was filmed of your first impressions while you were still there.
Mm-hmm. My dad, every day he would record me and ask me, like, what I learned and what I saw and everything that I experienced.
So how have your impressions now changed since those very first ones that got documented on film?
My impressions are still the same. I was just, my eyes were definitely opening, like, throughout the trip, and I was definitely learning different things throughout the trip. So I think that it was just, I learned a new thing every day. So, like, my mindset is just changing every day.
So, Kenneth, what did you hope that your daughter would get out of that trip?
You know, for me, it was watching her through my own eyes, because it was only 2 years before that I took my first trip there. And I remembered how I transformed over 9 days, you know, having been in America for as long as I am. I'm not going to say my age. And so, but to watch myself transform over 9 days from my own lens in terms of who I am as a Black American, and watching our African brothers and sisters and how they react and how they live in Africa, and then how that looks here in America. And I just was very curious about Nzinga. Nzinga was named after an African queen, to see how she would transform as well, seeing the same thing I did. And it was just amazing to watch how her perspective on who she was as not only a young Black female, but as someone who grew up in America, understanding American culture, to see how that juxtaposed to what she was seeing in Africa, and then how media has informed her and how her education informed her the differences between who she is here and who they are there in Africa.
And one of the comments that you make in the film is that you think that African Americans don't really understand a Black culture of Africa, and that Africans don't really understand Black culture as exists in the U.S. What does that mean?
Absolutely. That blew me away. The first year that we were there, we trained 300 Ghanaian teachers from across the country on new American techniques, educational techniques. And one of the workshops that I did was on community and parental engagement. And we opened up the workshop by asking them to tell us what they were told about America, and then we would tell them what we were told about Africa. Basically, we were just exploring assumptions. And one of the things that they said was that they don't really have a good sense of what racism looks like. And it was interesting because my brain was like, well, how can you not know that? And then when I thought about it, it was like, well, wait a minute. They're in Africa. They don't see racism the same way we see it in America. And what really blew my mind about that was when you look at how we level our expectations of a people here in America and how we and what we gauge ourselves up against, like particularly for African Americans in America, white Americans are always our gauge when we look at percentages and we look at research.
Right.
In Africa, their gauge is themselves, it's their own expectations. So they don't look at anybody else with respect to how well they're doing or how bad they're doing. They just look at their own culture. And that just really put me in a different space when it comes to how I see myself, how I see my children, and how I see our society here in America.
And one of the things, Zynga, that seemed to have struck you was the difference in attitude towards school.
Yes, definitely. Since people have to pay for school, they definitely care about it way more than us in America. Since it's given to us, we kind of like, we either don't want to go or we think it's not that important. But they really care about school and they want their education because they know with an education they can go somewhere farther in life besides the village or where they live, and they can take their education and do something very big with themselves. And here I feel like it's underestimated, like, oh, we don't need that. Like, we can do something else. We can still make money. But they really value education way more than we do.
Did you come back and talk about that with your friends?
Yes, I did. I definitely value my education way more than I did before. And when I get up for school, I'm like, well, at least this is free for me. And at least I'm going and I have the privilege to go to school when some people don't.
And you turn 18 this year?
Yes, I do, in May.
And where are you going after that, after school, after high school?
Kennesaw State University.
A proud owl to be.
Uh-huh, yes.
So, Kenneth, I assume this is all part of what you think of as responsible fatherhood. You opening this up to your daughter is mm-hmm. something that you see as part of your duty as a parent?
Absolutely. I think that we should always be exposing our children to more and allowing them to see more. And as I say, get their eyes off of their own square block. And so to be able to understand how people live and to embrace other cultures and to be proud of their own culture, and for them to kind of see and recognize and be proud of their history. And so, and always to be a servant. I think that once you begin to understand who you are in this world, you get a great sense of how you can be a help to the world. And so I believe that the broader our children's perspectives are with respect to who they are in the world, the more help they can be to others.
That would suggest, though, that this kind of trip could be replicated whether you are African American or not, that a responsible parent might look into how they can open up their kid who has Italian ancestry or Asian ancestry, mm-hmm. correct?
Absolutely. We were multicultural when we went on our trip, and the experiences that we all went through when we were there were the same, whether we were black or white. We had the same conversations on the bus at the end of the day about what we experienced and how we were going to go back home and think a little differently about the work and the things that we were doing here to help others. So I think that everybody, not only just going to Africa, I mean, I press upon my children that the world is their oyster. And so all of my children want to go other places. And Zynga's talked about going to Tahiti. My middle daughter wants to go to Spain. My son wants to go to Australia and see kangaroos. Every one of my children want to go abroad and see other things. And I just think that as parents, we have an obligation to broaden the perspective of our children.
We only have about a minute left in Zynga, but if you were going to make the case. Now, look, international travel is not something that's possible for everybody by any stretch of the imagination. But if you were going to make the case for it for young people, what is the benefit of traveling outside the U.S.?
Just to open your mind to new things. Like, the United States is not the only place in the world, and I feel like there's many different cultures. There's many different cultures that you can learn about. Like, we're not the only people, and there's many things that we can learn, and, like, we can learn about more about ourselves and other people to, like, better understand, like, the world itself.
That is Kenneth and Nzinga Braswell of Atlanta. The documentary about their trip to Ghana is called A Queen's Discovery. It was recognized in the PBS Film Festival To the Contrary. You can actually watch it at our website, gpbnews.org. Kenneth and Nzinga, thanks so much to both of you.
Thank you for having us.
I wouldn't mind going to Tahiti either, Nzinga. That is our show for today, but we want to ask you, okay, every single person, almost every single person, is carrying a little video camera with you. It's called your smartphone. So if you were to make a documentary, what would you film? Let us know. You can call us and leave a message at 404-500-9457. You can also post on Facebook or reach us on Twitter. The show is at OSD Talk, and I'm at Celeste Headley. For today, that's On Second Thought from GPB News. Have a great day.